The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Reoccurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in his Washington Times column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wonder, does the Bible teach that God created everything or that God is everything? Are God and creation one and the same? That's an extremely important qualification to be aware of. Pantheism is the view that God and the universe are one and the same. Everything that exists is God. Now, that is not the teaching of the Bible. In the Bible, God is distinct from the universe. The universe is his creation. He is something outside the universe, outside time and space. He is not the universe. Although that is the teaching of many New Age religions, we'll discuss this stimulating topic today. But first, the American dialogue about Osama bin Laden continues. And who better to continue it than Rosie O'Donnell? Yeah, Rosie. Now, last week, we played a clip from ABC's The View. Fun and clucking as the program may be, it just isn't the same anymore without Rosie O'Donnell. But be of good cheer. Rosie is still coming on Sirius Radio to make her comments. So welcome back a beloved feature of the Bob Siegel Show, our Rosie O'Donnell update.
You ain't got the money, the clothes are kind of funny, her hair is kind of...
You can be happy for the death of a person in terms of that he no longer walks the earth, that he, quote unquote, didn't deserve to live. You can also be upset about the fact that he didn't have due process, that he didn't get tried, that he wasn't, you know, brought to The Hague for war crime tribunal. You can have, as an American, you have the right to say, I wish that he wasn't killed. You know, America has always been the beacon of light and hope for the world, right? We're supposed to be the leader in terms of our morality and our democracy and our fairness, right? So saying the reason that it's all right for us to do that is because, well, look what they did to us. Well, that does not equate, because you don't want to become what you loathe. Wasn't the whole point of this is that we are not monsters, right?
Rosie, do we have to have another one of our little talks? Nobody is saying that you aren't entitled to your opinion, but any thinking person would challenge your opinion. No, we do not want to stoop to the level of our enemies, but exactly how are we doing that by celebrating the death of Osama bin Laden? Are you equating a murder such as slitting a stewardess's throat or cutting off an innocent person's head or slamming planes into buildings and destroying thousands of people with the justice of seeing an evil butcher stopped once and for all? As for due process, Rosie, how shall I put this? Osama bin Laden was not an American citizen. Do you get that? He was, by his own proud admonition, an enemy combatant who declared war on America. Even so, the idea behind due process is that a man is innocent until proven guilty. Obama confessed and bragged about what he did many times over. I know people argue over the legalities of international law, but there has never been a war quite like this. And the view that if it is a war, you are allowed to shoot the enemy without reading his Miranda rights is an acceptable view, Rosie. For myself, regardless of how people parse this legally, ethically, I had zero problem with the man's death. As far as I'm concerned, they could go in there and take him out whether he resisted arrest or not. Because he shouldn't have been arrested. He should have been shot. Ethical and legal, unfortunately, are not always the same thing. Well, that's our Rosie O'Donnell update. I know it was painful to listen to this drivel, but we need to know the world around us and the opinions around us. Even if the opinions make us feel like somebody is scratching a blackboard with their fingernails.
I'm a lucky fella, and I just gotta tell her.
To weigh in on any of this, as always, phone number 1-888-344-1170. That's 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach me on the internet, questions@bobsiegel.net, and through Facebook and Twitter. Tony on Facebook seems to share at least some of Rosie's sentiment. Although, to be fair to Tony, unlike Rosie, Tony is a Christian. But he says, Isaiah 43 says God has no pleasure in the wicked. I think he means in the destruction of the wicked. I think that's what he meant to write in there. For those who know what hell truly is, they will have none either. Now, if you're talking about Satan, that's a different story. Okay, so the point is, he's saying we should not rejoice in the death of a wicked person, but we can rejoice in the death of a wicked being, Satan. Well, Tony, according to the Bible, Satan was also a beloved creation of God, loved by God, who fell away into sin. What would be the difference between celebrating Satan's destruction and celebrating the destruction of other beings also created by God, loved by God, who tragically turned from God? And that is a tragedy, but then they're causing harm to others. If we can celebrate the elimination of Satan when he's finally removed from this world, how about those who follow him? Now, last week on the program, I read out loud, and I won't go through it again, but in Revelation chapter 6 and chapter 18, they encourage the saints to rejoice. And saints, by the way, in the scriptures means anybody that's given their life to Jesus Christ. It's not like in the Catholic Church where you have certain people that are saints. Everybody is a saint if they've accepted God's forgiveness. And so Revelation 6 and 18 are encouraging the saints to rejoice that their enemies have been destroyed. Yes, again, we would prefer to see them forgiven. We would prefer to see them saved. But if they do not turn and the world is now a safer place, that is something to be happy about. John, responding to my comments about Islam that I shared over the radio and wrote for Dearborn Free Press, says, Dear Bob, would you please answer several questions for me? So often I ask, but no one will dare to answer. We all are aware of the need for truth at all costs, right? 21st century answers. Thanks. The mayor of Dearborn wanted Pastor Jones to pay for his protection. From whom? Why did the U.S. forces have to go through a Muslim nation to kill a Muslim killer when the Muslims should have taken care of this killer themselves? 10 years, mind you. Did not the holy men of Allah brutally handle their own people in Iran? Why don't the Islamic nations have an army to stop the terrible atrocities performed by Muslims? Did members of the Islamic cult threaten to wipe Israel off the map? Why is America called the Great Satan by Muslims? Don't you think it's time for the truth? I guess the question that's begging here, the question that's John putting out is, if there's really so many peaceful Muslims, if just a few nutcases hijack the religion, then why don't the majority of the peaceful Muslims do something about it? And he's asking for an honest, blunt response. Well, John, I don't think I can be more blunt than this, because the truth is obvious and staring us in the face. It is also a truth that few want to accept in a politically correct world. Far more Muslims are violent and believe in the jihad than people wish to accept. Although there are also peaceful Muslims, the peaceful ones are not taking the jihad verses seriously, either because they are nominal Muslims, nominal being defined as a Muslim who grew up in a Muslim country but had a lighter exposure to the religion, or because they are doing verbal gymnastics to make the words in the text stand on their heads to say something other than what they truly say. For example, this other letter, a response from a Muslim to my article in the Dearborn Free Press, where I quoted from Surah chapter 9 that says, "Believer, make war against the infidel around you." This is a Muslim response from Karima. Karima says, "Context is everything, as you prove yourself. Therefore, your methodology, in order to be valid, must be applied equally to both books. It must be understood that the Holy Quran was revealed over a period of 23 years, and that its verses came in context to the situations facing the Prophet Muhammad and the early Muslim community. No translation or interpretation of its verses can be undertaken without a comprehensive study of the historical context in which each group of verses was revealed, or without a comprehensive study of the Arabic language, as any other language constitutes an interpretation and is not the actual text of the Quran to be dissected for depth of meaning by scholars." Well, my friend, it was scholars who translated the version I read from Arabic into English. So unless you're telling me that these Arab scholars were not scholarly in their knowledge of Arabic, there was nothing wrong with the translation I read. And I don't think you would mean to say that Muslims who live in countries where they don't speak Arabic cannot read and understand the Quran in a translation. I don't think you really want to go there, do you? Anyway, he continues. He says, "The above-mentioned verse in Surah 9 is in reference to a plot made by the enemies of the Prophet to kill him when he was returning from Tabuk, a battle undertaken to shake off the looming threat of a Byzantine strike at the much weaker Muslim community in Arabia on the heels of the Byzantine victory over the Persians under the leadership of Heraclius. Reports are that the advanced forces of the armies were already in Balqa, a northern border of Arabia. This plot was undertaken by those who were protected and had prospered under Islam economically and politically, flourishing trade, peace, and a just governance, and who had entered into treaties with the Prophet." Okay, let me respond to this. There's a kernel of truth in what he's saying, but a very small kernel. Have you ever wondered why there are a lot of verses in the Quran that talk about peace and a lot that talk about war? That's because originally Muhammad did try to spread his religion peacefully. When that didn't work, he commanded his people to take up arms, but that's the only thread of truth. In other words, I am agreeing that the context of these verses has to do with something that was really going on in Muhammad's life. I agree with that, but that's all that I agree with. I discussed Surah 9 in that article. Surah 9 does not give instructions on defending yourself from people who are attacking you. It is a command to proactively wage war, start the war with the infidel. An infidel is defined in the Quran not as one who attacks you, but one who will not convert to Islam. Nice try. I do appreciate that you are attempting to be a peaceful Muslim, but maybe you'd be well served to stare this religion straight in the face. Maybe then you can find the real God of peace, who happens to be the God of the Bible. Regarding our discussion last week about hell and the Washington Times column version of it, Campbell writes, "I appreciate this thought-stimulating article, and I am persuaded that while we as finite creatures, albeit sentient beings, are capable of grasping concepts like mercy and justice, we are not capable of grasping a person who at the same time is both simple and complex like the living God. He is complex in that he encompasses within his character the traits of mercy and justice, among so many others, and he is simple in that all the parts of his nature are equal parts of his character. He has made clear that his ways are not our ways and his thoughts are not our thoughts, so I seriously doubt that we will ever be able to comprehend the mercy and justice of God, nor to sit in judgment on his eternal decisions. But one thing is clear from Scripture. God has provided a means for all mankind to escape the coming judgment on the world, and that means is to embrace his only begotten Son and accept his free gift of righteousness by faith. As you have poignantly stated in your article, if God is just, there must be a hell, and if he is merciful, there must be a way to escape it. He, that is Jesus Christ, is the door. He is the way, the truth, and the life, without which no man can come to the Father." Well, thank you for sharing those thoughts. Robert on Facebook writes, "I believe that a hell exists, But what if our finite human mind determines what hell is, but not God's? That doesn't make a lot of sense, but what I'm trying to say poorly, that God's hell is much different from what we envision. Okay, well, there's a lot that we don't understand as human beings. That's true. And as human beings, we can't figure out God. That doesn't mean that God can't come down and reach down to our level and speak to us. When my daughter was 3 years old, I didn't talk to her about income tax or the hypotenuse leg theorem. I talked to her in a way that a three-year-old can understand it. And so through the Bible, God does explain some things. The Bible doesn't mean we figured out God. The Bible means God figured out us and spoke to us. So the Bible does fill some of these gaps. No, it does not explain all the secrets of the universe, but from the Bible, we understand where we came from, where we're going, and a little bit about how to live in the meantime. That's not bad. That's not too shabby. Without the Bible, we are left to do what scientists, artists, and ordinary passionate people have done for millennia. Look up at the stars, look into their hearts, and ponder and wonder why we are here, what the meaning of life is, and what the purpose of life is.
Hey, this is Lori K. Lewis, a frequent co-host on The Bob Siegel Show, Talk Radio 1170 on KCBQ. If you have questions or comments during this radio broadcast, please call Bob at this toll-free number, 1-888-344-1170. Again, the number is 1-888-344-1170. We'd like to hear what you have to say.
Welcome back to our program. Well, the Republican candidates are falling into place. Ron Paul decided to run for president. Big surprise. More of a surprise, Mike Huckabee decided not to run. Now, some were anticipating this. I heard a lot of pundits predict this, but others were not. Others were surprised by it. He probably feels that with his own television show, he can influence the country as a figurehead better than he would as an elected official beholding to voters. That's probably the truth. On the other hand, Newt Gingrich has openly declared his candidacy. He's been hinting at it for the longest time. I actually think Gingrich would be a great president. The problem is the guy's unelectable. There's no getting around it. The media pillaged him when he was Speaker of the House. Not that they're not going to pillage any Republican candidate, but they already did their number on Gingrich. I remember back then Time Magazine even did a cover story called "The Gingrich Who Stole Christmas." Unfortunately, pea brains respond to images like that more than ideas. If they paid attention to the ideas, they would realize, of course, that the sound policies of the House and Senate, after being returned to the Republicans under Clinton's watch, mostly because of Newt Gingrich and his contract with America, forced President Clinton to move to the center, forced President Clinton to embrace many of their financial policies. So while Gingrich's reputation was destroyed, Clinton came out smelling like a rose. Democrats always love to look back at that and talk about how the budget was balanced, blah, blah, blah. So Clinton gets the credit that belonged to Gingrich. Meanwhile, Mitt Romney has not yet declared, but he seems poised to do so. I'd like to talk about Romney in just a minute. First, I wish to pay homage to a dear friend who passed away 2 days ago. His name was Al Blackerby, a World War II Marine Corps vet. This was considered America's greatest generation, the World War II generation, and rightly so. And they're dying off, and boy, our country is the lesser for it. Now, Al was not famous, at least not beyond the many friends and family who knew him and absolutely loved him. Al was blunt and to the point. You never wondered what Al was thinking, but he was a generous man, a loving man who would give you the shirt off his back. Al was the father of my best friend in junior high and high school. He was like a second father to me. Then in time, when my own father disowned me for becoming a Christian, Al became like my only father. And like my only father, he sometimes gave it to me between the eyes when I needed it. I'll tell you a little more about Al and then move on and talk about Romney when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785, that's 447-8785, for W&S Electric Incorporated, license number 480-539, W&S Electric. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. I'm taking a few very important minutes to pay homage to Al Blackerby, a World War II veteran who passed away a couple of days ago. Not famous, but very beloved to those who just knew this guy, this incredible guy. I told you he was like a second father to me. And like a second father, he sometimes said the things that a spoiled, snotty 18-year-old needed to hear. Throughout junior high, I was not very popular, kind of an underdog. Became a little more popular in high school. I don't want to exaggerate this. I wasn't super popular, but a little bit more because I got involved with the drama club and was in some plays and wrote some plays. And so I had more friends. I had some girlfriends. I started dating. I began experiencing the fun of high school, but there had been some guys who'd been with me before I was that popular. And one was my friend Kelly, Al's son. Now, I don't want to make it sound like when I gained new friends, I shined off my own friends. I didn't do that. I wasn't that bad. But I did start going to more activities with my newer friends and less activities with my older friends. And that was going to include a special all-night at the beach graduation party that I went to with my girlfriend. And when Al found out that I wasn't coming to a graduation party held at his house for his son and close friends, he called me on the phone and asked me why I wasn't coming. I told him I was going to another party. Well, he made no bones about it. He gave it to me straight, told me that I had a lot of growing up to do. When he said that, I was uncomfortable. I was irritated with him. But my conscience bothered me afterwards, and I did go to his party and never regretted that decision. Those are the kinds of things when somebody cares enough about you to tell you that, even though you don't want to hear it at the time, that's the kind of stuff that stays with you the rest of your life. Throughout the rest of my life, I always thought of Al fondly, that he loved me and cared about me enough to just knock me off my block and wake me up. Al, I know you're in a better place. I know that heaven is richer, but earth is poorer. You will be sorely missed. Okay, but you might have missed the speech that Romney gave in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It was reported in a much-anticipated speech in Ann Arbor. Potential presidential candidate Mitt Romney talked frankly about the statewide Massachusetts health care plan, which came into being under his watch as governor and bears an uncanny resemblance to Obamacare. Many were wondering if Romney would make himself more electable by admitting that he had once laid a big turkey in the home of America's first Thanksgiving. Those who nurtured such hopes were disappointed. Said Romney, and I'm quoting him, "A lot of pundits around the nation are saying that I should just stand up and say this whole thing was a mistake, that it was a boneheaded idea and I should just admit it was a mistake and walk away from it. And I presume that a lot of folks would conclude that if I did that, that would be good for me politically. But there's only one problem with that. It wouldn't be honest. I, in fact, did what I believed was right for the people of my state." Okay, now Rodney did attempt to qualify his remarks by promising that as president, he would support more power to the states for health care decisions, allow tax breaks for people who purchase their own health care, and support the right to purchase health insurance across state lines. All repudiations of Obamacare and all obvious bones thrown forth to Republicans and other conservatives unhappy with Romney's Massachusetts track record. How Romney was able to deliver this speech with a straight face, and how he hopes to use this anti-resume to win any Republican nomination, aside from the alternative Republican reality in DC Comics' bizarro world, may be a mystery long pondered by historians. True, John McCain got the nomination in 2008 despite his support for comprehensive immigration reform, which meant amnesty, but we don't call it amnesty. We call it comprehensive immigration reform. And so that was a surprise that with that egg on his face, McCain got the nomination. But McCain at least expressed a shade of remorse. The truth is, people tend to respect politicians when they admit mistakes, although I must say, admitting one can also look suspicious, such as when, ironically, this very same man, Mitt Romney, changed his position on abortion before running for president, claiming that the decision had actually taken place a few years earlier during our nation's stem cell research debate. He made his new declaration in 2005, causing many to wonder if his conversion was a result of 2008 ambition. In any event, Romney's newfound view of abortion was quite a departure from emphatic words he shared while debating Senator Ted Kennedy for the Senate seat in a 1994 debate. At that time, Romney's view of abortion was this: "One of the great things about our nation is that we're each entitled to have strong personal beliefs, and we encourage other people to do the same. But as a nation, we recognize the right of all people to believe as they want and not to impose our beliefs on other people. I believe that abortion should be safe and legal in this country. I have since the time that my mom took the position when she ran in 1970 as a U.S. Senate candidate. I believe that since Roe v. Wade has been the law for 20 years that we should sustain and support it. And I sustain and support that law and the right of a woman to make that choice. And my personal beliefs, like the personal beliefs of other people, should not be brought into a political campaign. Okay, now those were the words of Mitt Romney in 1994 at a Harvard University-sponsored senatorial debate. To be fair, and we always like to be fair on the Bob Siegel Show, Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush also switched from pro-choice to pro-life positions amidst their political careers, just as Dick Gephardt and Al Gore saw the light coming from the other direction. Such observations can be frustrating. At the expense of making a whale of an understatement, whether they admit their mistakes or own up to their mistakes, the motives of politicians tend to look suspicious. True, clear confession of an error after gaining office may sound a little more sincere, but even then, the soul-searching is often an explanation for why some campaign promise needs to be broken or postponed. Where, then, does this leave our poor voters? Should they throw up their hands with despair? Should they just give up and stop voting altogether? Actually, some simpler but no less cynical wisdom may be in order. Come to grips with the fact that we are electing people, not gods. Even if a candidate changes his position merely to get votes, the only relevant question is whether or not he will deliver what he promised. If, for example, the pro-life community is looking for someone to champion their cause, Mitt Romney's motive for reaching out his hands doesn't really matter at the end of the day. No, there may not be a guarantee that he'll come through, but the chance is zero if a pro-choice candidate wins instead. Likewise, Romney's current view of health care is more important than his past view of health care. Also, we have to ask ourselves how much one human being can do while they're in office anyway. When Dorothy and her friends discovered that the great and powerful Wizard of Oz was really the man behind the curtain, Dorothy rebuked him out of her pain. She said, "Oh, you're a very bad man." At which time he replied, "Oh no, my dear, I'm a very good man. I'm just a very poor wizard." Well, at the top of the hour, we teased you with a discussion question. Is God the creator of the universe, or is he just one and the same as the universe? And we will return to this subject when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Your own website without a lot of cost and trouble? Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to tell you about Web Studio. Web Studio allows people to create their own websites simply and easily without knowing HTML. With Web Studio, you avoid the learning curve of front page and the expense of a web designer. Web Studio has 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and everything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com.
Welcome back to our program. Did God create the universe, or is God just another name for the universe? When the Bible uses the word God, it means a thinking, feeling entity who created the universe and who holds each of us personally accountable. But there's a much different and very popular idea of God, the notion that God and the universe are one and the same thing. In other words, God is everything. This idea, commonly called pantheism, is gaining quite a following in modern religious thought, even though its roots are ancient, some of them going back to certain sects of Hinduism. A Christian says that God made the tree. A pantheist says, no, God is the tree. We couldn't possibly have two more distinctly opposite views of God. Now, there are different strains of pantheism. Some insist that the God universe is a non-personal phenomenon. The universe doesn't think. The universe just is. It's almost like saying there's no God at all. There's just the universe. There is only existence. But other pantheists will claim that the God universe does have a personality. This view suggests that the oceans, rivers, stars, and planets somehow make up one collective sentient being. We live in a country that guarantees freedom of religion, and I would never want to see that change. I respect the rights and the sincerity of people who have a different view of God, be it pantheist or any other belief. At the same time, all too often we tend to give religious ideas a free pass without taking the time to question them according to their logic or authentication. Just because we want to see them remain legal doesn't mean we can't question them. And why is it that people assume that logic can't be brought into a discussion of religion? Because the underlying assumption going into such dialogues is that religion doesn't really have anything to do with truth anyway. Supposedly, it's only a comfortable fantasy. Telling someone to choose Christianity over Hinduism or Islam is like arguing over the Chronicles of Narnia as opposed to the Lord of the Rings. They're both fantasies. So what difference does it make? Just pick the one you like. Now, when discussing other disciplines, history, science, math, politics, people are very interested in facts. But religion? Oh, that's a whole different story. Should it be? I mean, even a religious idea is a truth claim. The founders of most major religions did not suggest for a minute that they were espousing mere opinions or comforting fantasies. They emphatically insisted that their beliefs were based upon divine revelation. In other words, they were claiming truth. If you're a college student, let me put forth a question. Shouldn't students at an institution of higher learning test all truth claims? Religious or otherwise? Of course, that question is just as relevant to those of you who aren't in college. Equating God with nature may sound nice. It sounds nice. It's not that God made the forest. God is the forest. It's not that God made the sunset. God is the sunset. It's not that God made the weather. God is the weather. He's the rain, the lightning, the thunder, and he's the crystal clear water pouring over every smooth stone in the Bonnie Brook. Doesn't that sound nice? It's almost poetic. But do we want to accept an idea simply because it sounds attractive? Here's the problem. When we say that God is everything, we must admit that everything is a pretty big word. Everything includes, well, everything. When somebody tells me that God is everything, I like to ask them, you mean I'm God? You're God? Is my wristwatch God? Am I wearing God on my wrist? When I eat a hamburger, am I eating God? When I have my morning coffee, am I drinking God? When I empty the wastebasket, am I tossing God in the trash can? If I hike through the woods and step in some horse manure and then scrape it off with a stick, am I scraping off God from my shoe? Am I this time, of course, here? Oh, no. I don't mean all those things are God. You don't know. Oh, I see. Okay, you don't mean that all those things are God. Well, then, when you say that God is everything, what do you mean? Sometimes people make the horrifying discovery that they had no idea what they meant. It just sounded good. The Bible paints a much different picture of God. Genesis 1 says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. It doesn't say God was the heavens and the earth. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. A familiar verse, to be sure, but the role of God as creator was taught throughout Scripture, both Old Testament and New Testament. Job 38, God talking to Job, he says, where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? And then it says in the New Testament, in Romans, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. So as you see, the Bible does say that we can learn some things about the Creator from his creation, but it is still called creation. The Bible also teaches that our Creator will hold us accountable for the way we live our lives. Acts 17 says, "For he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice." Since Christians base their beliefs on the authority of the Bible, the credibility and authentication of the Bible is also fair game. For the sake of time and brevity, I will address the accuracy of Scripture on a future show. Of course, we've already done that on many shows, but I'll do it again. That's what this program is all about, after all. For today, though, let us simply ask if the Bible's view of God makes any kind of sense. You can decide whether you believe in the Bible later. Sometimes people just assume that what the Bible says about God and the universe is the same as the New Age view, and I'm showing you today that that is not the case. Does it make sense that design implies a designer? The human body is a far more complicated machine than any computer or any automobile. We would have trouble imagining such machines coming into existence by mere accident. According to Pantheist View 1, mentioned before, this universe, which some may call God, is impersonal. It has no sentience, no intelligence. Well, then who designed its complexity? And how do we account for human personality? Friends, you cannot get the personal from the impersonal. As for the idea of a God who holds us accountable, is that not consistent with our very own societies? We got into this a little bit last week when we were talking about hell. Don't we have laws and courts to prevent anarchy? Don't we forbid people to selfishly hurt others? A good case can be made that we drew up such laws because we have a conscience inside condemning evil and making us feel guilty if we aren't trying to treat others in a way that we ourselves would want to be treated. Where did this conscience come from? Maybe our joint intuitive awareness of judgment and accountability finds origin in a being who will literally hold us accountable someday. It would be very difficult not to at least consider such a possibility. According to the second pantheist view, this conscience may just be a part of the eternal conscience of the universe. But if God is everything, according to that view, then God is also everybody, according to that view, which means God is also evil people. This would make God himself evil, or at least partly evil. It would mean that God was Adolf Hitler. It would mean that God was Osama bin Laden, or it would at least mean that those personalities are part of God's personality. That does not wash, not if we wish to approach this subject with a degree of logic and creativity. Well, we have some more comments by email, so we'll get to a few of these. And again, you can reach us, questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel.net. We'll get to them when we return.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's daily blog on townhall.com. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net. Here, you download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. BobSiegel.net.
Welcome back to our program. Well, on last week's show, I mentioned that the death of Osama bin Laden gave new life to the Obama campaign. And responding to that idea, Eddie says, I hope it was just enough life to let him crawl back to Chicago in 2013 when hopefully America returns to its senses. That would be nice, Eddie, for America to return to their senses. I don't have a lot of hope of that. But here's a guy that's always pretty sensible. He writes us from time to time. This is Mark in El Cajon, and he's writing about Osama bin Laden. He says, hey, Bob, now that Osama bin Laden is dead, some liberals seem to think that the light is at the end of the tunnel as far as the war on terrorism is concerned. Well, I say not. His death is not the beginning of the end, but rather it is the end of the beginning. We as a nation and a people are now entering into the middle game, which means this fight against terrorism is going to last a long time, in my opinion. So Obama got Osama, but Osama got Obama to hide his body from the... I love the way people are mixing up the name Osama and Obama, and I did it myself. Hopefully you didn't catch it. Of course, if you didn't, now you're catching it because I'm pointing it out to you. But I was talking about Osama, and I accidentally called him Obama. The names do sound a lot alike, except for the B, except for the S. But I don't think President Obama has to answer for as much as Osama does. But I do think President Obama has to answer for some. Anyway, Mark's having fun with this Obama-Osama thing. He says, I can't believe the incredible irony of that. And he puts laughing out loud. And then Obama had him buried at sea all because Obama is worried about an Osama backlash. So they go and they wash the dead body before burial. Oh, but we can't inflame Arab sensitivities, he says sarcastically. I say hogwash. Instead, he should have shown the face of death, which would demonstrate to the world that America is still a nation to be feared and that this is what happens when we catch up to terrorists. President Bush showed Saddam's son's bullet-riddled bodies to the entire world, which proved we feared no one to exhibit these pictures. Then he has a rhetorical friend arguing with him sarcastically again. Now, Mark, you have to realize and understand that things have changed since then, and the Muslims have become overly sensitive with such grotesque and shocking depictions on TV. Why, their feelings might even become hurt and distorted, and then they might even become enraged at such a sight. There's just no telling how much anger that might generate. Jeez! It might even turn more Arabs into suicide bombers. And then Mark says, oh, for God's sakes, we could never have won World War II if today's two sensitive liberals were in charge back then. I've read historical articles of when fighter pilots were shot down over Japanese-held territory. They knew they faced a gruesome reality. If caught by the Japanese, it was an almost certainty that they would be tortured. Sometimes those sadistic Japanese soldiers would string up the pilots while they were still alive and cut meat off their actual living bodies and then cook and eat that right in front of the dying pilots. When this was discovered and the news got back to our troops about such atrocities occurring, what do you think was our troops' reaction? Did they call for an immediate press conference and say, well, we don't want to overreact here and possibly hurt Japanese sensitivities or some other silly liberal free good comment? No. What the U.S. Army 14th Infantry Division did was to cut off the heads of every dead Japanese soldier they could find, and then they impaled those heads onto all the tanks as they went into battle. I've even seen pictures of this, so I know it's real. And I must say, I had never heard of that before. I've studied World War II quite extensively. That doesn't mean I'm claiming to know everything about it. If our soldiers actually did that with Japanese heads, that would be very interesting. So I'm reading this letter cold. I'll look into that. I've known Mark. He's written other letters before. I've known him to be pretty accurate with history himself, so I'm not necessarily doubting it. I am just telling you that I had not heard that. So I, like you, am finding that kind of shocking and kind of interesting. Anyway, Mark continues. After the war, the defeated Japanese army told the Americans how seeing all those decapitated heads on our tanks put absolute mind-numbing fear into the minds of the Japanese soldiers who witnessed and saw those tanks coming at them. That's the only way to win a war. So I say take the fight to them and whip them at their own game. Then and only then will peace come about. However, I fear as long as our president is worried about what Arabs think and feel about us, then the terrorists will become more and more emboldened to fight back as they will sense a weakness in President Wimpy O'Blah-Blah. Sincerely, Mark. Well, that part is absolutely true. And that I can guarantee you can take that to the bank. Making deals with terrorists only emboldens terrorists. So I absolutely agree with that. A couple of weeks ago, I began a discussion on the question, who killed Jesus, the Jews or the Romans? I began at the last few minutes of the program and promised you I would continue it the following week. The following week, I did not continue it. I let the news events drive some other programs. So today I had decided to continue it. And so what am I doing? I'm continuing it right when we come to the last few minutes again. But there's a major difference this time. This time when I promise I'm going to continue it next week, I don't mean I'm going to continue it by fitting it in somewhere next week. I promise to continue it at the top of the hour. A lot of debate about whether Jesus was executed by the Jews or the Romans. That's an important debate to Jews because throughout the Middle Ages and even far beyond the Middle Ages, Jews were persecuted with the term Christ killers, as if Jesus didn't come to die for all of us. So there is a lot of question who killed them, the Jews or Romans. And it's a little sticky because the Romans were running the land. The Romans had conquered Israel, but the Romans did give the Jewish government considerable freedom. And yet under Roman law, the Sanhedrin, the Jewish court, did not have the authority to kill Jesus. So they didn't have that authority. They couldn't kill him, but they would have if they could because they didn't like Jesus. So instead, they gave him to Pilate, the Roman governor, and he had Jesus killed. Thus, all the debate over who killed Jesus, the Jews or the Romans. Actually, it was a collaborative effort. Some claim that this New Testament report not only contradicts the facts of history, but also does so with an anti-Jewish agenda. Well, let me bring in a few pertinent ideas here. First of all, the New Testament does not teach that all Jews killed Jesus, rather certain hypocritical Jewish leaders. Many other Jews in Israel were the ones following Jesus, his disciples, and he had far more than 12 disciples. He had over 100 disciples, plus multitudes who'd been fed by him and healed by him and were listening to his teachings. A lot of people loved Jesus, and the original church was made up almost all of Jews, 99.9%. When a Gentile wanted to become converted, the Jews would get together and argue whether the Gentile had to become circumcised and become Jewish first. That's how Jewish Christianity was when it began. Christianity simply means a follower of Christ. Christ is the Greek word for Messiah. The Jewish Messiah is what's central to the word Christianity. And even some of the Jews who voted to have Jesus executed later on became Christians themselves. One of them may even have been the Apostle Paul. We know that he had been a member of the Sanhedrin, but the book of Acts does tell us definitely that many Jewish authorities converted. We see the Sadducees and priests converting to Christianity in Acts chapter 6. We see the Pharisees converting to Christianity in Acts chapter 15. Not all of them, but some of them. Also, and this is very important, the New Testament was itself, for the most part, written by Jews. The Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts would be an exception. Now, please grasp the significance of this. By the way, I'm Jewish myself. It is from Jews that we get the account that Jesus was killed by Jews. Although those authors, when they wrote the New Testament, had converted to Christianity, their love for Israel never went away. Let's look again. I know I shared these words with you before, but it fits the context. Let's look again at the words of Paul, a former rabbi. I'm reading from Romans 9, 3 through 5. For I wish that I myself were cursed and cut off from Christ for the sake of my brothers, those of my own race, the people of Israel. Theirs is the adoption as sons. Theirs is the divine glory, the covenants, the receiving of the law, the temple worship, and the promises. Theirs are the patriarchs, and from them is traced the human ancestry of Christ, who is God over all, forever praised. Amen. That would be a good verse to show your friends who claim that the New Testament is an anti-Semitic book. It speaks very highly of Israel. However, and this is another very important point, it was common even in the Old Testament for Jewish writers to be painfully honest when fellow Israelites did not obey God. The Old Testament is the story of the Jews just disobeying God continually. I always hear this today. History is written by the victors. History is written by the victors. Oh, yeah? Well, whether victorious or not victorious, throughout the Old Testament, which showed many Israeli victories and many Israeli defeats, the Jews, the writers of the Old Testament, were painfully obvious. Israel did what was evil in the eyes of the Lord, and the Lord allowed their enemies to conquer them. And then later on, the people cried out to God, and then God called up a deliverer. Now, when we go outside of the New Testament, there's a very interesting Jewish book. It was handed down orally, but you can read it in a book now. It's called the Talmud. And in the Talmud, they also take responsibility for the death of Jesus. They kind of leave the Romans out this time because in the Talmud, they liked to imagine that they were completely governed by God's law and the Romans weren't even around. It was a literary device. They said on the eve of the Passover, Yeshua was hanged. That was the Hebrew word for Jesus. For 40 days before the execution took place, a herald went forth and cried, "He's going to be stoned because he has practiced sorcery and enticed Israel to apostasy." Now, why would they call him an apostate? Because he called himself God. Why would they call him a sorcerer? Because in those days, if you didn't like somebody, but you couldn't deny the fact that he did miracles, you called him a sorcerer. You claimed he did it by the power of Satan. Jews today don't tend to believe in Satan. Most of them don't, but they sure did in those days. So here's a source outside of the New Testament claiming that Jesus did miracles, very significant, but the Jews are also taking responsibility for the death of Jesus. More on this next week.
Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.